Truism number one with economic news is that with the good usually comes some not so good. Poverty in America on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 12th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We have said not infrequently on this program that context matters, that this number or the other isn't much good without knowing the bigger picture, what it all means for how people live in their economic day-to-day. Consider that, then, the caveat with our lead story today, some new data from the Census Bureau on poverty in this country. The official poverty rate in America has dropped a full percentage point. Last year, that meant about 40.5 million Americans, 12.7% of the population, was under the poverty line. Also, median household income went up a bit more than 3% to $59,039 a year. That was a whole mess of numbers, but they do matter. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going with the upside.
This report has some positive news for everyone, says Indever Dattagupta of the Georgetown Center on Poverty and Inequality.
While we certainly have a long way to go, we have moved virtually every indicator of well-being released in this report in the right direction.
Although there are still significant gaps between men and women, whites compared to blacks and Hispanics, all groups saw gains in median household income. Orrin Cass is with the Manhattan Institute.
And so it means that at least somewhat, the growth that we've seen since the recession and things like the stock market is also starting to show up in people's households.
Remember, we're talking median income here, not average. Some of the boost is just because the wealthiest incomes rose. But Elise Gould of the Economic Policy Institute says there is still reason for optimism.
For the vast majority of households, particularly those non-elderly, most of their income is coming from the labor market.
And according to many experts, quality of life is improving. Scott Allard is with the University of Washington.
I also think this is a reflection of expansions in safety net programs, like access to Medicaid or expansions in SNAP, that allow families to overcome barriers to employment and keep a job.
So that's the good news. But many Americans are still feeling economic frustration. My colleague Andy Euler in L.A. has that story.
There are certainly good things about these numbers. But for a lot of Americans, things don't feel better. Why? Peter Capelli at the Wharton School says part of it depends on where you live.
So if you're making $59,000 and you're living in San Francisco or the Bay Area, that just doesn't go very far. And you're really living like a person who is not at the median.
And he says while people may be taking home a little bit more, expenses are increasing. Not just housing costs or college tuition, but things like out-of-pocket contributions for health care. Yeah, the poverty rate is down nearly 1%, so we have fewer Americans deeply in need. But that's very different than being financially healthy, says Justin Wolfers at the University of Michigan.
I think the thing we often forget is just how many people are getting by on under $35,000 a year for the whole household.
He estimates that's 35 to 40% of Americans. They're not impoverished, according to the strict definition. For a single parent of two kids, the poverty line means making less than $19,300 a year.
People who are, say, raising two kids on their own and making $22,000 a year feel pretty poor.
Emily Martin is with the National Women's Law Center. She says that feeling pervades the entire nation.
I think that one thing that is consistent in each part of the country is that someone above, just above the poverty level is going to feel like it is incredibly hard to make ends meet, especially if they're taking care of children.
The rise in median income and drop in poverty do signal the economic pie is growing. But the slice of that pie for the poorest Americans? It's probably not. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, that pie kept on a-growing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A lot of the conversation you hear in this country about globalization is about the downside, the costs of jobs going somewhere else. Take a second, though, to consider the view from somewhere else. Billions of people in emerging economies are now seeing the benefits of globalization and are finally starting to catch up. So for the latest story in our series, Trade-Off, about the goods and bads of globalization, Marketplace's Scott Tong made a trip to tell the growth story of the Indian economy.
One way to understand how fast the Indian economy is running is to join Indian men who are running. On a cricket pitch in Kansas City. Really, this is a technology city, home to companies like Sprint and Garmin. These software and IT professionals spend their Saturdays batting and pitching. I mean, bowling. League president Suresh Kannan bats righty, works for Sprint.
When I came here back in 97, there was only maybe a couple of teams. Not great players. You got to go call players and beg them to come to play, you know. Since then, total number of players are around 600.
The Indian community here, now 7,000 strong, has boomed as the economy back home has exploded. This is a global story of Indian talent connecting with U.S. education and technology and investment. India's economy is growing at 7% a year. It's the fastest growing large country in the world, a place where the average income is now less than $2,000 a year. Economists often call this catch-up, where poor countries adopt proven technology and ideas by opening up to the outside world. But for all the whooping, there's now tension, as the Indians here question how open the U.S. is to them. In February, at a bar in the suburb of Olathe, a white man shot two Indian men, IT workers, cricket teammates, and killed one. The shooter first asked about the men's immigration status. Aviva Ejmera is an Indian American who works as a business strategy consultant in Kansas City.
Even if you're born and raised here, when something like the shooting in Olathe happens in your community, everybody feels vulnerable because we look different.
Now she looks over her shoulder more often, watches other people watching her, even though the city rallied for its immigrants right after the shooting.
The Kansas City community, not just the Indian community, came together just to show support for the Indian community. I mean, kind of the message was, yeah, that happened and it was awful, but that's not our city.
Her concern is not just the shooting. People of Indian descent have heard of White House proposals to limit H-1B visas for skilled workers. And they heard Steve Bannon blast South Asians in a Breitbart talk radio show in 2015. This audio went viral just after last year's election.
You know, when three quarters of the CEOs in Silicon Valley are from South Asia or from Asia, I think my point is that a country's more than an economy. We're a civic society.
The resentment could have something to do with who's catching up. For three decades now, fast-growing economies like India and China have narrowed the gap with the rich world, while working-class incomes in the U.S. have stayed flat. Economist Branko Milanovic at the City University in New York says one does not cause the other, but some might think it does.
That was seen as one indication of why there was disenchantment with globalization or why maybe these people voted in favor of Brexit or Trump.
In Kansas City, fewer college applications from India are landing, and fewer Indians are being hired by companies nervous that the visa rules could change. Now, there's no wholesale exodus, but things have changed since the earliest IT workers came in the early 90s. Back then, India was just emerging from a Soviet-style, centrally planned economy. As in one TV channel, says Suresh Kannan of the Cricket League.
If you have a TV, you are a rich person. We basically forced our parents to buy a TV, and we bought a color TV, and we were like a popular family around the neighborhood. They used to call us a color TV family.
Then in 1991, India's government opened up the country dramatically, and in came American companies, investors, lowbrow TV shows.
Like you.
The popular shows was a Jerry Springer show.
Jerry Springer.
Yeah. We used to think it's all real.
People throwing chairs at each other.
Yeah, all those things. And, yeah. And then watching Baywatch was a shock for us because that's something completely against our Indian culture at that time.
Great moments in globalization. Manoj Manithumarial is an IT entrepreneur in Kansas City. He graduated college, and in the 90s, he studied programming in India. And that is a key ingredient to the country's catching-up recipe, which includes education, democracy, openness, investment, and entrepreneurs. He was hired in the Bangalore office of the Digital Equipment Corporation based in faraway Massachusetts. At the time, U.S. tech companies were recruiting heavily in India.
And I think the primary motivation was that year 2000 computer problem, Y2K problem. They were going to rewrite the code, so they need huge manpower.
Eventually, he got hired by a firm in Silicon Valley, and then he moved to Kansas City to form his own company. Why there? Nice people, cheaper housing.
Only thing we didn't like was the winter, the cold.
And there are other disconnects. Many Indians are vegetarians in the land of Kansas City barbecue, trying to grasp American jokes.
So when I sit in meetings, somebody crack a joke, and I will have to synchronize my laugh with them. And then later ask, what did it mean?
Like all business owners, Manithumareel competes on price. And often, the best bang for his buck is to outsource the simpler IT work back to India. And that revenue back home is helping to fuel a rising consumer economy. The average income in India is rising 3 times faster than it is here. Economist Branko Milanovic.
We're really talking here about a rebalancing of the world and significantly higher incomes in Asia. And I think openness and globalization played a very important role in that.
The upshot? Today, there's a thicker global economic middle.
It is a very favorable, very good development, and it led to what I called actually the largest reshuffle of incomes since the Industrial Revolution.
And some believe that despite the recent backlash, the U.S. will remain connected to the India growth story. Ramanan Lakshmi Narayan is an economist and epidemiologist who lectures at Princeton. He says both countries are connected by language, democracy, technology, and worldview.
These are places that will be connected in mind, certainly not by geography, but certainly in mind space, which is the most important space. I don't think an H-1B problem of today or one crazy guy in Kansas is going to change that story.
For India's catch-up, there's still a long way to run.
Good running.
And at the center of this is a bunch of cricketers in places like Kansas City, global middlemen in a global game. Right now, laughing at an American reporter trying to play theirs.
You have to get used to it.
Flailing in Kansas City, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
This isn't an office. This isn't an uptight room that you're in. You can let loose a little bit.
Yes, you can. But is that always a good idea? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 61 points today, 0.2%, close to 22,118. NASDAQ up 22 points, 0.3%, 64.54. S&P 500 up 8, also 0.3%, 24.96. Record highs today. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said, again, tax reform is just around the corner. That and general relief that the world isn't coming to an end, I guess, is the root cause. Bank of America up 2.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase added 1.2%. Citigroup deposited about 1.5% today. McDonald's in spotlight after an analyst reported weak sales forecast. That plus likelihood that Hurricane Harvey and Irma are going to mean fewer Big Macs sold for reals. Shares down 0.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Adrian Hill was telling us yesterday, September 11th, of course, about the building and financing of all the memorials to victims of mass violence in this country that are being built. Today, maintaining those memorials, keeping them functioning and relevant even years later. Here's Adrian.
Oklahoma City, April 19, 1995. Here's NBC's Tom Brokaw.
A massive car bomb exploded outside of a large federal building in downtown Oklahoma City.
168 people died in the blast. Hundreds more were injured. In the years that followed, the community, with the help of the state and federal government and private donors, built the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum. This is from the walking tour.
We come here to remember
those who were killed,
those who survived, and those change forever.
In 2015, on the anniversary of the bombing, former President Bill Clinton gave a speech on the grounds.
For 20 years, you have honored the memories of your loved ones. You have inspired us with the power of your renewal.
But the work of remembering and renewing and honoring can be expensive. Kerry Watkins is the executive director of the Memorial and Museum.
We spend about $1 million a year on the outdoor memorial, keeping it up to date and running it and operating it in a way that where it stands as it was the day it was open.
The foundation spent $10 million a few years back to update the museum, to add technology and artifacts. It raises a significant portion of its revenue through ticket sales, a marathon each year. There's money from the gift store, an endowment, and traditional fundraising.
And while we want to maintain the sanctity and the beauty of the story, there is a business side to it, and you have to figure out how to balance those so that you're not offending people as well.
The Oklahoma City Memorial is on a large scale. Most memorials to mass violence don't have former U.S. presidents willing to come speak on anniversaries. Most are meant for their communities. And for all the promises to always remember, memorials can be hard to maintain.
I think a lot of people think that memorials are permanent and are forever.
Erica Doss is a professor of American Studies at Notre Dame and author of the book Memorial Mania, Public Feeling in America. She says many memorials being built today include plans for preservation and maintenance, 5, 10, sometimes 20 years. Longer than that?
The life of a memorial is also very much about those who want to take care of it, lay claim to it, want to respond to it.
Which brings us to the Edmund Post Office Memorial, a 30-minute drive from Oklahoma City. August 20, 1986, a postal worker in Edmond, Oklahoma, killed 14 of his co-workers. And with the help of public donations, the community and the U.S. Postal Service created a fountain and sculpture. It cost around $100,000 and was unveiled in 1989.
I go by there once a week, probably.
That's Herb Retke. He says he's one of the few people who still pushes to keep the memory of that day in people's minds. He worked at the post office in 1986. He wasn't there at the time of the shooting. His shift hadn't started, but his friends, co-workers, and brother-in-law were killed.
Well, I just drive by the memorial. Sometimes I don't stop because I can't stand that long. But anyway, I go by there and see how it is and remember all the guys and girls.
The fountain stopped working for a while. It dried up. But the pipes were repaired in time for the 30th anniversary last year. Retke and a friend organized a ceremony.
I intend on doing more every year as long as the good Lord lets me on earth.
For this year's anniversary, the 31st, there was no planned public memorial service. But Retke bought 14 flags and placed a wreath with a yellow ribbon and the words, "Never Forgotten." I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
When you think about a restaurant, yeah, sure, you think about the food. You almost certainly think less, though, about how that restaurant works, how the room is run, why the menu is the way it is, how the ambiance sausage actually gets made, so to speak. That is Jen Ag's job. She's a restaurateur based in Toronto, where she runs a handful of restaurants, about which she writes in her new book. It's called I Hear She's a Real Bitch. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, Kai.
So I should say, before we actually turned the microphones on and started recording, I asked you how you should be identified, because I like to make sure I get that right. And you said writer and restaurateur, or restaurateur and writer, either one of those, which is comfortable, and that's fine. We'll do that. I noticed you didn't say chef. You're not a chef restaurateur. You just run the places.
Yeah. No, I'm definitely not a chef. No. That's a common misperception.
Yeah, and I wanted to clear that up.
Thanks.
You got into it, though, via, we should say, cocktails, basically, right?
Yeah, I mean, I got into it via needing a job as a teenager, really, and realizing, I don't know, like, I don't really understand these young kids who go into retail for minimum wage when you can make so much more money and have a lot more fun in restaurants.
Do me a favor and describe the dining room at the Black Hoof, your first big hit restaurant. And I don't mean describe it, what it looks like. Tell me about the mood. Tell me about the sense.
I think restaurants really are extraordinarily mood-based. So I think people think that they go to restaurants and they just want to eat the food. But really, I think the atmosphere, the service, the lighting, the general vibe, the way you feel when you're in there contributes to so much more about your experience than you sort of maybe are willing to admit. The Hoof is intended to feel very casual, comfortable. It's a cool space without, I mean, it's hard to use the word cool because you end up sounding kind of like an apple, but like, it's just like, it's a straightforward space. But I think that when you walk in, you're just immediately sort of triggered by the fact that it's a fun room. It feels good.
You still work a shift, right?
I do. I still work often. I'm right now, because we just opened Grey Gardens, which is our new place in Toronto, I'm there
all the time during service, just kind of watching and monitoring the room and talking to people and managing a little bit here and there. But yeah, and I still like to do hosting shifts every once in a while at the Hoof.
What does it mean to you to be able to do that?
To be plugged into... Okay, so this whole business really does revolve around the idea of family. And it's not just for practical purposes that you're like seeing these people you work with every day more than you see your actual family. But if you are too unplugged from that in a real way for too long, and I know lots of restaurant owners probably are, but it doesn't work for me. I need to actually connect with these people that are working so hard for me and, you know, making the places actually operate properly. It's all about your staff. So if you kind of turn away from that, or, you know, you're busy expanding and you're not actually in your rooms and checking things out, it shows.
You are, though, running, frankly, I've lost count, 4 or 5 high-profile places. Can't be in all of them at once. How do you keep yourself plugged in?
I go to Montreal a lot to check in there. So we have Agricola Montreal, yeah. And I just got back. I was there for the day, basically, yesterday. I flew in at noon, and I was out by, like, 6 p.m. the following day. And it doesn't seem like a lot of time, but I was able to have, like, FaceTime with the managers and the cooks and, like, just connect with the staff. And then in Toronto, I ride my bike around a lot. So the restaurants are all really close together. There's the Hoof, Rum, and Cocktail Bar, and this sort of trifecta on Dundas. And it's like this little island of loveliness that we built for ourselves. And it's very nice. So we just, yeah, make it work.
There's an American-centric question I have to ask, mostly because I don't want to have to go to Toronto and go to the Black Hoof. Are you going to come to the States anytime soon?
Wait, you know what? Toronto's not.
Look,
okay, listen,
I like Canada. I lived in Ottawa for 2 years, coldest years of my life, lovely town, but I froze my yayas off. But so, you know, L.A. maybe, New York? I don't know.
I never say never, but I don't want to. It was really, really difficult to open a restaurant 500 kilometers. That is, I don't know, 260 miles for you guys. Can you guys just adopt the metric system
look,
already?
Don't get me started on that. I know.
It's time.
I know.
So it seems unlikely, although I love coming to L.A. to visit Jess at Squirrel. So I'm going to be definitely coming and doing something soon.
This book is about a lot of things. There are a lot of threads in this book, right? There's creativity. There's hard work. There's sex. There is also... sexism and the misogyny that you find in the restaurant business, and it's not something that is apparent in popular society because, you know, you got all those cool cooking shows and this and that and celebrity chefs, but it's real and it's there.
Right. I think what's really interesting about restaurants is we're in the business of public-facing hospitality. Usually, I think that's why people, as sort of guests and customers of the restaurant, they don't see it. You know, people that are maybe perpetuating this terrible culture are able to turn on the charm, and you're going to be a little bit maybe blinded by that. I think that's a part of it.
Give me the rest of it.
Well, I mean, it's many prongs. It's a male-centric industry, first of all. I don't know too many women who are chefs, let alone restaurateurs. I mean, obviously they're out there. Obviously that's changing. But yeah, so you've got kids coming into the industry really, really young, learning this sort of wild west of kitchens And I mean, that's part of what keeps these young men and women interested, you know, in these 12-hour days, is that this isn't an office. This isn't an uptight room that you're in. You can let loose a little bit. And I think when it goes too far, and it often does, that's where the problems start to happen. So it's trying to find that nuance for people and explain, well, no, you can still actually have fun, but you can rein it in and not make this, like, young immigrant dishwasher the butt of the jokes.
Yeah. You've been doing this 15, 18-ish something years.
Maybe more like 20.
Is it really 20? All right.
23. Okay. I mean, I've been doing it since I was 18 and I'm 42 almost.
Okay. Is it getting better?
Yeah. I mean, yes. And that, you know, I don't know. Like, I feel like right now the climate in our world is terrifying. So, no, I don't think it's getting better. Sorry.
it is what it is. I ask the questions, you answer them.
Yeah.
It's a book called I Hear She's a Real Bitch. It's a great read, I got to tell you, by Jen Ag. Jen, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. You read it. That's really nice.
I did read it. Come on. Yeah.
Thanks.
This final note on the way out today, in which I am pretty sure we can finally be all done with those big Apple product announcements. Big news today from Cupertino. As you heard, iPhone 8, iPhone 10. Don't know what happened in the 9, but that's not my business. That, though, is not what I want to talk about. This is from the Reuters Wire as the big reveal was going on. And this is a quote. Apple exec shows off animated poo emoji at Apple event. I mean, we're done. Am I right? Also, why would you want to animate a poo emoji? You know. Dow up today 0.2%. NASDAQ up 0.3%. S&P 500 up 0.3% as well. Tommy Andres is the producer on our Special Projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Maybe they know the answer. I don't know. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.